Hello. Thank you for staying, hardcore listeners. This is part two. Thanks you very much for staying, and thanks to the literature program for sponsoring, and to Scott for organizing things. It's great to be tolerated for not one but 2 hours. In this part, we will talk about the digital humanities and answer the question of what the story about culture as a management problem has to do with the story about the story of a film as an outsider to the Academy, we hope. So, here we go. A broad and lively discussion within academe offers digital humanities as a rubric under which the humanities might rediscover their biopolitical mission. Writing last month in Inside Higher Ed, Paul Jay and Gerald Graff symptomatically portray digital humanities as the cutting-edge intersection of humanities and computer science, the merging of skills and points of view from two formerly very different fields that are leading to a host of opportunities for students interested in writing computer programs, electronic publishing, interface design, and archive construction. This simultaneously vanguardist and vocational activity makes clear, Jay and Graff contend, that if there is a crisis in the humanities, it stems less from their inherent lack of practical utility than from disdain for such utility. The fear of being useful is a distinctly humanist phobia, they argue, albeit one perhaps most powerfully felt in English departments. In a way, the first part of the talk offered a genealogy of such a peculiar phobia. The fear of being useful is the effective remainder of the power plays associated with Leavis, Crow, and Ransom, which legitimated criticism by retreating to the Academy and at the same time complained that academics were not empowered to manage cultural production. Useful criticism by these lights would lose its raison d'etre. We find it particularly telling, then, that in proposing digital humanities as a worldly challenger to New Criticism's frightful ghost, Jay and Graff dig up an even older conception of humanist labor. Reproducing what Newfield regards as a rhetoric foundational to the modern university, Jay and Graff cast humanities professors primarily as teachers, charged not only with inculcating in their students' behaviors appealing to companies and state administrations, but also with giving them an ethical compass. To take advantage of the vocational potential of humanities study as we propose, write Jay and Graff, is not to sell out to the corporate world, but to bring the critical perspectives of the humanities into that world. This view, we have been arguing, could benefit from acknowledgement that it gives humanities experts a biopolitical mission.
Rather than positioning the digital humanities as the latest antidote to a lingering mid-century fear, we prefer to think of its potential as what Alan Liu calls an institutional desiring engine. This means, he argues, displacing the question, how can the digital humanities serve the humanities, in favor of the question, how can the digital humanities help the humanities and higher education serve larger society? To answer how the digital can help the humanities be of service requires first a practical understanding of how the digital modifies humanities, and second, a working knowledge of the mediations linking academic expertise with professional efforts in other institutions. Capsule histories of the digital humanities habitually overleap the early 20th century changes we chronicled in our first talk. Liu's sketch is typical, both in this regard and in its depiction of the digital humanities as a loosely structured field arising from the primarily text-based legacy of humanities computing and emerging areas of new media studies. Apart from a nod to Marshall McLuhan, one would never know that many of the new media studies scholars Liu cites have film studies backgrounds. In his essay, and in a truly remarkable number of efforts to map what Patrick Svensson calls the landscape of digital humanities, the media themselves can seem to have undergone no significant change between Gutenberg and Google. Text remains the dominant carrier of meaning, Svensson contends, even in some of the projects appearing in Vectors, an electronic journal edited at the University of Southern California, that prides itself on exploring, quote, the immersive and experiential dimensions of emerging scholarly vernaculars across media platforms. Haystack collaborator Tara McPherson, a cinema and media studies scholar, obviously knows that the media changed demonstrably between the age of print and that of internet, and to be fair, so does Lou. Nonetheless, early 20th century mass culture is curiously absent from most discussions of how digital humanities arrived at its present. This is unfortunate. Precisely because Hollywood cinema did so much to reshape the discipline in the first half of the 20th century, that earlier era conditions and should inform the question of how the humanities might be of service in a moment fretfully entranced by digital wonders.
To be clear, cinema matters to this argument today because it institutionalized new practices and altered others, not because it has inherent value as a disciplinary object of study. To think of film studies in such object-centered terms is to treat it as an analog of the version English invented in the middle of the 20th century. Then, Ransom described the popularity of prose over poetry as a homicide in progress and urged critics to band together and intervene. Such new critical crime prevention finds a peculiar echo in Yale film scholar Dudley Andrews' 2009 defense of the film object. Writing in Critical Inquiry, he argues that film exists differently or not at all when kidnapped by consumers and sequestered on their computer desktops. To rescue film and restore it to the cinema, Andrews argues, requires driving a wedge between film studies and media studies. Only this will enable the resumption of efforts to develop a cogent film studies methodology that the rise of a more diffuse media studies derailed during the 1990s. Like Ransom, Andrew identifies rigorous disciplinary method with the ability to theorize an object. Where Ransom insists on poetry as a literary form distinct from prose, Andrew insists on film as a medium that derives, quote, its remarkable psychological and cultural voltage from the temporal gap between viewers and the world on screen, a, quote, delay and slippage enhanced by the contemplative atmosphere of the darkened cinema. Like Ransom 2, Andrew depicts disciplinary film studies as the guardian of an object and an experience more recent, more popular media forms threaten to transform beyond recognition. Kidnapped by computers and confined to tiny display windows, cinema, which ruled the 20th century, will no longer recognize its birthright unless a revitalized film studies comes to the rescue. Andrew's essay makes a more helpful contribution to thinking about the status of film in the Academy in its opening frame than in this alarmist conclusion. Andrew begins his assessment by inviting his reader to imagine there to be a force in cinema still capable of tossing scholars from the saddle while they try to rein films in to disciplinary paddocks. Here, Andrew imagines that a discipline's object necessarily exceeds efforts to wrangle it. This is so because a discipline is, as Andrew puts it, an alloy composed of method and institution. Almost in spite of itself, Andrew's brief intellectual history ably demonstrates that disciplines form through contests that are as much about relations within broader academic and cultural fields as they are about developing a core method through which scholars might recognize newcomers as one of us.
We agree that humanities disciplines are institutional creatures whose analytic techniques never exhaust their examples. What muddies this worthy insight for Andrew is not his defense of a particular conception of film, but rather his conviction that the future of the discipline depends on one. The past of film fails to provide anything like such a singular vision, and in fact testifies to the vibrant debates that inspired diverse commentators precisely because they did not agree on what film should mean. Andrew both ignores and continues this history of debate when he portrays new digital media as a threat to film. The conviction that digital media amount to a threat predictably draws strength from the mistaken notion that what differentiates film studies from English studies is the former's lack of an object-centered method. Andrew finds that English professors know how to sound like English professors in such circumstances or in debate circumstances by deploying, quote, some form of rhetorical analysis, whereas film and media studies faculty lack such a shared approach and thus find themselves incapable of commanding the attention of their peers. Andrew's experience in this particular does not jibe with our own. In any case, we suspect his description may compel readers by appealing to the disciplinary common sense that mid-century English professors on both sides of the Atlantic worked so hard to establish, namely, that English knew what it defended, whether that prized object be understood as minority culture, poetry, or literary language. And it knew from whom it was defending this object. Andrew repeats that common sense in his opening observation that half a century ago, cinema's place in the university was a matter of debate. Cinephile suspected the stuffy academy, and academicians looked down on the movies. Such a debate over the very propriety of its study, Andrew writes, seems primordial enough to distinguish film from English or any other long-standing field. In fact, as figures ranging from Babbitt and Springorn to Adler and Leavis attest, the debate over whether and how the university should properly include studies of mass culture is primordial for English and perhaps all humanities disciplines.
Arguments for the digital humanities' usefulness revitalize this early 20th century mission statement and recall its challenges. As the trigger for an institutional desiring engine, the digital reactivates an early 20th century mode of humanities dispute about media. That said, much depends on how the desiring machine turns. It spins in place when digital humanists behave as if change depends on knowledge of an object. There can be no better example than Kathy Davidson's effort to give urgency to educational reform by claiming that the internet has changed everything. This effort took shape through the Haystack Collaboratory, founded by Davidson and David Theo Goldberg. Among the most prominent and best funded digital humanities efforts, Haystack defines itself first as a consortium of humanists, artists, social scientists, and engineers committed to new forms of collaboration across disciplines fostered by creative uses of technology, and second, as the future of thinking in a digital age. In 2007, Davidson blogged, "The World Wide Web is the steam engine of the information age, which requires a historical remapping of all the key issues of how knowledge is exchanged, how it is created, what its role is in the world, how it functions and changes, how one kind of idea influences another, how knowledge travels." Done right, she predicted that such a remapping would inaugurate an age of the humanities. Currently serving a 6-year term on the National Council on the Humanities, Davidson is in a better position than most to represent the coming age to policymakers and big funders, and she continues to appeal to the revolutionary novelty of the digital. Her 2011 book, Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn, turns to the eminent historian Robert Darton to contextualize our information age. According to Davidson, Darton argues that there have been only 4 times when the very terms of human interaction and communication have been switched so fundamentally that there was no going back. Epical change, she quotes Darton as arguing, resulted from the invention of writing, movable type, mass printing, and machine-produced paper and ink, which democratized print at the end of the 18th century. And then there's now, our very own information age, the fastest and most global of all the 4 great epochs in the history of human communication. The primarily textual character of the media shifts Darton identifies is perfectly understandable in the context of the short New York Review of Books essay that Davidson cites. There, Darton worries Google will erase an important continuity by making old books newly digital. "I want to argue," this is Darton, "that every age was an age of information, each in its own way, and that information has always been unstable." This polemical reminder is more important than the periodization Davidson appropriates. It requires to acknowledge that media don't define epochs, histories do.
Davidson et al. May have something to teach us about what makes new media new, but the force of their argument lies elsewhere. In calling attention to this disjuncture between the pedagogical goals and practices of our educational system and the skills demanded and learned outside it, the workplace demands that managers must be constantly connected, while the classroom tell students to shut off their cell phones. Precisely this type of disjuncture, we have suggested, motivated Great Books pioneers to include cinema in their curricula, inspired Thrasher's social science humanities crossover efforts, and encouraged deans to court motion picture executives. In reaction, it prompted Leavis to imagine an English school that could defend minority culture. Since the early 20th century, the university has been defined by the problem of mediation that Davidson declares new. Haystack and digital humanists do not discover a gulf between media students' use and their educational institute, between media students use and their educational institutions teach. They are calling new attention to this familiar disconnect. There is an important misrecognition here, but not one about what makes media new, so much as about what media do. Media authorize competing varieties of expertise. They set up contests and potential collaborations among professionals trained and credentialed to behave as if changes to the form, content, and/or technology of media matter to the welfare of the populations connected by them. It was through a series of arguments in which Hollywood cinema played the role of the exemplary mass medium that this rule stipulating that media authorize interdisciplinary competition and collaboration emerged. If something called the digital humanities succeeds in truly refashioning the way the university conducts its business, it will not be by isolating the digital and transforming it into an object akin to Ransom's poetic language or Andrew's cinema. Rather, it will be by revitalizing an early 20th century tendency to forge connections among, for instance, specialists in American literature and brain science, semiologists and social scientists, even English professors and film and media studies scholars. Academic disciplines thwart collaboration when they fall victim to the belief that their identities depend on the coherence, unity, and sophistication of their attempts to define an object of interpretation.
We agree with Davidson and Haystack that collaboration is an essential skill for the present, and that it matters a great deal how that collaboration is imagined. Collaboration that fails to grapple with the question of what the university is for remains an empty signifier. Liu paints an even dimmer view, noting that much of the text-oriented side of the digital humanities has been almost wholly uninterested in any social, political, economic, or cultural inquiry into the contexts and implications of information technology. By the same token, he regards the new media wing of the digital humanities as indiscriminately critical of social and global informational empire without sufficient focus on the specifically institutional, in this case higher education, issues at stake. With Haystack, Liu calls for attention to possibilities of collaboration across academic and industrial fields. This recalls the collaboration we found in the early 20th century among filmmakers, critics, and teachers. It also strikes a chord with the discussions of the crisis confronting public universities, where work that crosses the boundary between the academy and industry appears to signal a division of labor internal to academe. Colleen Lai, Christopher Newfield, and James Vernon introduced the recent special issue of Representations on the Humanities and the Crisis of the Public University by observing that engaging in collaboration across institutions is a privilege reserved for upper administration. Senior administrators increasingly address themselves to their own non-faculty peers in industry, government, and boards of trustees, Lai and company lament. Having identified a serious and urgent problem in the fact that CEOs and provosts are remaking the university behind closed doors, this special issue responds by calling for a more sophisticated discussion among a specifically academic audience, and not one involving potential voters or donors, but other humanists. There are some obvious limitations to that approach. It seems to us that the solution is not to make our own work more popular per se, as commentators across the humanities often claim. Rather, what humanities scholars lack is practice in an appreciation of a professional division of labor and a means of relating their specialized work to forms of expertise outside the humanities. Although historians and social scientists certainly worry about whether they are talking to themselves, they may be better positioned to make their work relatable because they never equated discipline with the effort to specify a media object. English scholars are just catching up to their social scientific brethren when they exploit the notion of digital humanities to conceive of various publics and to consider ways of addressing them. To wit, opening access is important less for how it remakes our standard forms of publication than for how it may make us rethink the relationship between our scholarship and expert writing more generally. This is so whether one considers what happens to expertise in authorship after using crowd review of the sort employed by journals like Postmedieval, or when aggregating textual and visual projects like those compiled by Media Commons and its sister site, hashtag Alt Academy, which focuses on alternate careers for humanities scholars.
Nostalgia for an earlier division of intellectual labor is of limited value to this rethink. Writing in the same issue of Representations on the crisis, on the humanities and the crisis of the public university, National Humanities Center Director Jeffrey Galt Harpum is pleased to locate the salad days of American higher education in the moment exemplified by Harvard's 1945 Red Book and funded by an alliance between philanthropists in the Andrew Carnegie mode and Truman-era tax dollars. In this heyday of general education and core curricula, funding humanities research supported a, quote, perhaps quixotic and definitely nationalistic, but fundamentally noble attempt to create a society unified by the common opportunity to rise through education to the level of one's merits. The 1965 National Foundation of the Arts and Humanities Act eroded this project in two ways, according to Harpum. It rhetorically placed federal support for the humanities under the shadow of Cold War politics. And in contrast to funding for big science, it emphasized humanities teaching at the expense of humanities research. Ultimately, this trend culminated in the disasters of the Reagan years, which set federal funding for the humanities on the downhill slide, from which it shows few signs of recovering. At around the same time, according to Harpum, the, quote, bare-knuckled capitalist patrons of liberal education's halcyon days gave way to venture philanthropists. This, quote, new breed wants a quantifiable return on a social investment. It inclines towards science, technology, and management, and away from the humanities. In response to these dangerous new times, concludes Harpum, quote, we must make every effort to reclaim, reactivate, and reinvigorate our own cliches. What worries us about this call is not the agreeable and valid argument that a liberal arts education is good for juries, op-ed pages, and dinner party conversation. It clearly is. We are dismayed, rather, by Harpum's cynical embrace of a mid-century rhetoric built to find, quote, American democracy in the alliance of big state nationalism and robber baron capitalism. This alliance did not fund democracy in any direct way. It paid for meritocratic educational institutions. Such institutions work to certify and distribute the authority to represent and manage others. The logic of a, quote, return on social investment has never been as foreign to them as Harpum would have us suppose. This confusion of meritocracy and democracy shapes a good deal of the commentary most alarmed by the current unwillingness of voters and their representatives to fund higher ed through taxation. Thus one finds Wendy Brown, otherwise an incisive critic of liberalism's self-representations, regretting that, quote, the idea of a well-educated public, one that has knowledge and understanding to participate thoughtfully in public concerns and problems, has gone the way of public goods and provisions themselves. Cold War funding made it possible to treat the university as a bastion of freedom, untainted by the consumers and investors that Brown portrays as now corrupting hallowed ground. As with Harpum, this framing leaves Brown in the paradoxical position of simultaneously lamenting the passing of a, quote, radical democratic event of extending liberal arts education from the elite to the many, and thinking it, quote, fortunate that the elites, Princeton, Amherst, or Chicago, remain preserves of the liberal arts for a while longer. Faced with the choice between imagining that anyone who cares about the public mission of humanities should try for a job at the elite privates, on the one hand, and the digital humanist's desire to collaborate with the tech sector, on the other, we suggest choosing the latter. It seems important to insist that whatever the future of the humanities holds, it ought to entail consideration of what is happening to management within and without the university. When Christopher Neufeld provides the statistics to prove that high enrollment humanities departments fund loss-leading research in the sciences, he effectively reminds humanities scholars of the opportunities inherent in the curricula they control. There is leverage here to affect how the university as a whole prepares its students for life outside the academy. Thinking the future of the humanities need not and should not require us to perpetuate accounts of once proud disciplines laid low by the corporate university.
New histories produced by film and media scholars starve off such victimization, we believe, by defamiliarizing the disciplines. They invite us to replace familiar stories of disciplinary origins with genealogies that weigh moments of unexpected collaboration more highly than moments of foundation. Read in tandem with the familiar histories of English, the new histories of film and media suggest that the humanities have been interdisciplinary in something like the same way mass media have been intermedial, achieving specificity by studying and distinguishing themselves amidst rival forms. This intermedial encounter ought to remind us further that humanities objects are themselves moving targets produced and reproduced by non-academic institutions. The future of the novel will not be decided within the university any more or less than the future of the feature film or Facebook. To be sure, part of the humanities' job is to investigate what distinguishes these media, their forms, and the social relations they mediate. And humanists really should try to avoid leaving out major media, like cinema, when limiting media history. Nonetheless, whenever we imagine that our disciplines will thrive if they succeed in defending an object, we risk aggressively planning for our own obsolescence.
There is no need to be phobic of the next new thing, as is far too often the case in English departments and film and media studies departments alike. For a case in point, one need look no further than Stanley Fish's New York Times opinionator blog. Fish greets with ridicule another year of high-profile digital humanities panels and papers at the MLA convention, scorning digital humanities as the new dispensation, whose prophets tell us that if we put our faith in it, we shall be saved. Responding in his own blog, University of Illinois English professor Ted Underwood urged literary scholars not to rise to Fish's bait. DH is really not another movement to revitalize literary studies by making it relevant to X, he writes, and it is counterproductive to fear or desire it to serve in that capacity. Digital humanities functions as an umbrella term for efforts broader and less coherent than any discipline, and he observes, quote, it is not even restricted to the ranks of faculty, but also includes academic professionals, and especially librarians, among its leading figures. Underwood's refusal of Fish phobia has a partner in the equally valid point that the humanities need not fear the digital because they have already been significantly digitized. So far as we've been able to determine, not even the most venerable members of our departments work without word processors. Fears and hopes of salvation are beside the point in determining how these tools change the ways we work and we might work with each other.
An array of initiatives have worked through disciplinary fears about usefulness, novelty, and the abandonment of precious objects. The world is replete with conferences, workshops, team talk courses, and collaborative programs devoted to something interesting, doing something interesting to the digital present. For example, in 2005, the program in cyberdisciplinarity run by television scholar Mark Williams at Dartmouth College's Center for the Humanities hosted a conference that not only... Wow, this is a terrible sentence.
Yeah.
They hosted a conference that included faculty from across humanities disciplines and also put those faculty in conversation with geographers and sociologists, legal commentators, and the political cult consultant Joe Trippi. Then there are an array of projects aiming to energize collaborative research by providing new digital access to research materials. For example, the University of South Carolina's Moving Image Research Collections Digital Video Repository Project promises access to thousands of hours of previously unseen material from diverse collections. It is easy to grasp how for librarians and film scholars, historians and students in visual culture might find themselves embroiled in debates about how to use these films which cannot be understood as Hollywood movies. At least I hope that's easy. Likewise, the Transliteracies Project housed in part at the University of California, Santa Barbara, habitually spawns working groups of computer scientists and English professors, information studies experts, and studio artists invested in socially mediated computing and knowledge production. More broadly, whole categories of digital work, such as locative art or augmented reality, would be unthinkable without contributions from cartographers and computer scientists, visual artists, and even famous novelists like William Gibson. Where high-profile endeavors like Wikipedia survive on donations, more than half a million people donated more than $16 million in 2011, smaller archival digital research and teaching projects find funding in diverse places, including the NEH Office of Digital Humanities, corporate donors, and private foundations.
The practice of digital humanities is ahead of its theory. Existing projects provide ample evidence of the kinds of collaboration that policy statements are prone to cast as elusive. The problem is not finding such projects, but distinguishing among them. Here is the best reason to follow Alan Yu in setting aside the question of what digital humanities can do for us in favor of the question of what they are actually already doing to governmentality. Thus, locative art projects typically pose questions about what happens to power when GIS makes it possible for any person with a smartphone to populate their surroundings with virtual materials while simultaneously being tracked by who knows how many corporations and government bureaus. Equally important to us is the way that some collaborative projects reflect upon the terms and hierarchies of collaboration. Mark's Digital Archive aims to do this by introducing a volume of new evidence and inviting diverse constituencies to use it to revise accepted histories. Transliteracies does it by bringing together a bunch of humanists with employees of Intel. For a contrasting example of a collaborative endeavor that does everything it can to foreclose questions about the expertise that makes it go, there's always Google, the proper name for what is certainly among the most complex corporate instantiations of an international division of labor, neatly fetishized in the search box. In this crack cocaine of internet practice, a long history of cross-disciplinary endeavor goes misrecognized as technological revolution, if we bother to notice it at all.
Programmatic pronouncements at the level of policy and discipline may fail to notice existing collaborative practice because the intervention called for by scholars including Liu, like the democratic intervention craved by those akin to Brown, imagines a world outside the university characterized as society with a capital S. For this reason, to Liu's question, how can the digital humanities help the humanities and higher education serve larger society, we would add our own. How are existing instances of humanist collaboration enabling the formation of small but innovative societies, two lowercase s's? Where Liu and Davidson ask us to scale up, to think even bigger, we think it equally important to scale down and embrace all of the markers of digital micropolitics, from clusters and breakout groups to hashtags and memes. No one big project will save the humanities. There is no one next big thing. To imagine there might be, in fact, is to miss the way digital mediation really does differ, the way it replaces the problem of mass culture with that of database culture, its local customizations and flexible scales.
The present may well be teaching us that the mass was a bad problem all along. The configuration of mass versus minority seems, in fact, to include a whole array of institutional affiliations that digital humanities make available in the present, and that the institutional turn in film and media studies make apparent in the past. As commentators from Bledstein onward have emphasized, the humanities were built to propagate an ethos of curiosity and public service suited to the age of professional administration and expanding bureaucracy. If the humanities are now in crisis, it may be because the experts in charge of administering and defending them fail to appreciate that the forms of media culture typically identified as mass were of deciding importance to those foundational arguments. Thus, they failed to prepare the university to engage moments of rapid media transformation like the one we are currently living through. An awareness of how contemporary arguments echo early 20th century concerns about the capacity of film and literature to affect their consumers can help today's humanities scholars intervene in the administration of media in the present, not least by cautioning against repeating the same mid-century mistakes.
The future of the humanities lies in the perspectives our disciplines bring to bear on governmentality. For all its disavowals of quantitative methods and social science, the humanities could claim no place in the modern research university absent the conviction that their efforts mattered in defining populations, securing their welfare, and improving their future prospects. This is as evident in Babbitt's defense of the Book of Job as it is in Patterson's effort to uplift pupils through filmmaking craft, Thrasher's transformation of movie-going knowledge into normative judgment, Leavis's elevation of the sensitized reader, Horkheimer and Adorno's critique of aesthetic administration, as well as more recent pleas to return to the darkened theater, to revamp pedagogy for digital natives, and to restore the humanities as ethical training ground. The more clearly we understand that these very different projects are allied in caring about how culture intervenes in governance, the more clearly we can distinguish projects on which we would like to collaborate from projects we want to resist.
A not atypical ruse of those seeking cultural authority in such circumstances has been to defend the old against the new. Thus, Andrew's retreat to the hallowed hall of the cinema, reproducing Ransom's retreat before him to the poetic lines of metaphysical verse. Since mid-century, this defensive posture has dominated the humanities, which have, as a result, effectively ceded the authority to manage generations of new media to government and industry. Those agreeing that the mileage has run out on this strategy should refrain from defending existing forms as if text messaging and YouTube were about to make them extinct. They should equally refrain from celebrating new media forms as if they make movies and novels extinct, or as if they will inevitably lead to qualitative new forms of administration. Making visible how media forms get institutionalized, how they are used, how they recycle content and remake it, this is a shared project humanities disciplines must face head on. Precisely because content matters now more than ever, it should provide the full array of media experts a rich field of opportunities to collaborate and to intervene in how it should be understood, organized, and encouraged. Though scholars spent most of the second half of the 20th century misrecognizing this fact, it is in fact the state of affairs bequeathed us by the development of the humanities after Hollywood. Thanks. So did we make Ralph happy?
While you're pondering a question I was remiss earlier, I'd like to thank the literature program for sponsoring this event. I'd personally like to thank Scott Ordolano for his indefatigable work.
Thank you.
And I would also like to thank Dr. Robin Gooden for all she did. Questions?
We can ask all the same ones again, or we can.
Yes, you can do it. Just
or we could.
We shouldn't have cut Bauerlein.
Yeah,
it's totally your fault, so this is your question.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, we cut Bauerlein. We have So first of all, your comments have mimicked a set of comments made about cinema in the 19-teens and 20s, which was submitting consumers to hypnotic receptivity and was making them passive and consumption. And that looks to us like a foundational argument that people in the humanities and the university have, which we ought not to repeat. So the form of the question repeats the thing we want to oppose. By acknowledging that these moments of media transformation have thoroughly reworked the imagination of what democracy would mean at least a century ago, and I guess we're not persuaded by the cell phones rot your brain research. As much as we may be evidence of it. But I think our most important target in Bauerlein was his proposal of how we should reconfigure the university in response. You want to pick up there?
I mean, so the idea that we're only talking to ourselves, you know, that he's rehearsed in the Chronicle a few times, and which echoes the kinds of things one reads in Thomas Bender, right, writing also in the Chronicle, about history departments and their inability to engage with a kind of mass public. It seems to us...
A proposal to reconfigure the university around au courant problems.
Yeah.
Do you know this,
who's
this version
the Columbia
of his
University
art?
Guy? Mumble. There's the guy at Columbia, do you remember his name, who wants to revise departments so that they're no more departments, yeah. They're just issue-centered...
Thank you.
Groups. These kinds of responses, especially Bauerlein, seem to us to not, or to think about what we can say mostly in terms of whether we're narrowcasting or whether we're, you know, disseminating a certain kind of quality media to a much larger public. And one of the things, as we suggested, that digital media ought to show us is that scaling up and scaling down is actually less of an issue than working outside the little boxes in which we're trained to work. That doesn't lead us to the Taylor, you know, sort of refashioning of the university, but it does lead us to some sense that that we need different ways of talking to one another that don't require us to demonize either what's out there or what's across the hall.
Yeah, something like that. Barry, are you traffic copping, or should we do that ourselves? Robin?
Sorry, Robin. I want to ask Helen's question again, but in the context of the second talk. Mm-hmm. So when Helen asked a question about theater, you said, but there's something like a break. You didn't want to call it a break, but it's something like a break at this point, and so you wanted to position your history there. But when Dan asked his question, suddenly it's not a break, and history is seamlessly moving forward. So I want to know, how do I know when there's a break?
There isn't a break.
No, there are all kinds of breaks.
Right, or there are all kinds of breaks. Either will do.
Yeah. I think that the constellation of arguments in the early part of the 20th century, which involved cinema and a bunch of institutional development, were significant. And we think we're living through a moment that may be a moment of equally significant change, but that's not how you would narrate that is not yet written, and so we're wanting to lodge a comparison with that earlier moment. We're wanting to put that in an account of how you might understand the difference of the present.
But at the same time, I think we'd be perfectly happy to think about this as embedded in a longer debate associated with the Ehrenreichs, who Barry mentioned, and Harold Perkin and other people about the rise of professionalism and the problem of professional administration and its job of mediating capitalism. So that these, I mean, I would prefer something like moments rather than breaks. That there are notable changes, but they don't constitute an epical shift.
It's a genealogical mode. You find fractures as, you know, this cousin marries that aunt.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, that I would agree with, which is that there is an ethical shift going on now, and that to jump on board with it is, I don't want to suggest the humanities, because that's exactly what you want to contest, but will merge certain kinds of corporate think with
So I think that our problem with that line of reasoning is its disavowal of the way that humanities think is already corporate think. We think that that's setting up a phony opposition between a university that was somehow isolated from the corporate university, which was a mid-century fantasy, which was enabled by corporate funding and tax dollar funding. So we are open to all manner of opportunities for reconfiguring what the humanities might do to the university outside, but we don't want to imagine that yesterday the university was pure of corporate culture, and today it's in danger of being corrupted by it.
I mean, this is. But to say that is to precisely say we're not living through an epochal shift. We're living through differences in emphasis. It's not the Cold War anymore. But the difference between the Cold War and neoliberalism is not, you know, an absence of culture of corporate influence on the university in one instance and, you know, its full impact.
Our contention is that the modern American university humanities departments are biopolitical in orientation. That's how they justify themselves and do what they do. So it's that Foucauldian sense of governmentality.
Yeah. Exclusively? I mean, what about something like the aesthetic, ethics?
That's all biopolitical. I mean, you could talk about counter-governmentalities or whatever, but it's not an outside. There's not an outside to the humanities. It's concerned with nurturing populations outside itself. You bet. That's why they pay our tax. That's why they pay our salaries, to improve lives of students. I mean, and you know, if you think you're training them to resist, you're still embracing that project.
God. Sorry, I just said, oh my God.
Yeah. We should have done some reading preparation.
Seriously.
In terms of this, right, but like the nationalist agenda that seems to be tied into this,
yeah.
Right? Like if you look at Adler and the Great Books Program, this interest in Buchanan who's trying to revise St. John's College, there's this interest that bringing cinema into it is, even though we talk about Hollywood as a synecdoche for cinema, Hollywood is always transnational, but the interest in bringing cinema into the Great Books Program is promoting this national character, right? And then I thought it was great that you brought in Dudley Andrew, because Dudley Andrew did his PhD in an English department as a comparatist on film theory, working on Zen, and now he's in a comparative lit program and a film media program, but not an English program, I think, at Yale, right?
Yeah.
And in his article from PMLA, he talks about how the resistance to film studies and the desire for disciplinarity is in part tied into French theory and the work of Bart and but also Jakobson and Russian structuralists, and how that's going to influence what English people are doing with film. So I'm wondering if the purge or the departure of comparative lit film studies is tied into an underlying concern that the role of English departments of literature programs is somewhat nationalist, communal, patriotic.
I mean, it's one of the currents that confuses us most in reading about the crisis of the humanities is the relationship between neoliberalism now and an earlier formation that had no problem saying it was nationalist, and now that seems to become a different kind of proposition. So Wendy Brown's piece in Representation seems to us sort of symptomatic of this. But I lost the second part of that question to
you. Well, there are two threads that come together here. One is the conflation of English with the humanities, or accepting the narrative in which the English gets to represent itself as the humanities, which is something what we got it we want to very much develop in the rest of the paper and examine that assumption. And then the other is the way that move plays into a story about the national mission of humanities departments, which film and media studies sometimes presents itself as confounding in its internationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the introduction of theory, right?
Right.
So what's interesting about this moment is you have those kinds of thinking along those lines, and then you have people like Harpham and Brown looking back to a moment when you could say that the humanities deserve funding because they served a national purpose, a national trying to reactivate that old rhetoric. And so I think that we find that tension an interesting thing about our moment, and we haven't quite mapped. I don't know if we know yet where we wind up on that. Do we?
No.
We don't know yet. You want to help us write the next chapter?
No. I just thought it was, the more I read it, it was just interesting.
Yeah. Film and media studies has always wanted to imagine itself as more internationalist than the English department in the post-war period. But the 20s debates, I mean, one of the things that maybe got submerged in our discussion of all the literary arguments is how freely they move back and forth across the sides of the Atlantic and actually involve a lot of French intellectuals, so, you know, HD and Close Up and so forth. So you can, we could develop this teens, 20s, 30s moment we're interested in as significantly more internationalist than we do. You want to ask your question again about that?
I happily retract for our question. I have a different one. How much a sort of resistance to digital humanities changes in your research on this? You're thinking about it, and you're sort of casting it from the point of view of an English department with the unique history that you articulated. So how does that, the flavor of resistance or its stakes,
the history thing, I feel like we haven't figured out either. I mean,
well, one interesting thing we discovered, right?
Yeah.
We put the Roy Rosenzweig Center for Digital History slide up there, and we wish we could have talked about more about that project. But we were trying to find history examples that identify themselves as digital humanities. There are a few. There are many more that identify themselves as digital history. In digital humanities, under the rubric, I mean, I'm just talking in terms of like search engine search terms, you know, looking through JSTOR, you know, where the articles are, you find a lot of digital humanities arguments in English literature journals, and those arguments often take the form of the Underwood argument. It's not a discipline, it's a broader rubric. So that's interesting. It's interesting to see in this argument over the digital humanities, a return of the argument about whether this thing is another name for revised English or whether it's something else. And I think we like the reason we kept repeating that line from Alan Liu is that we're less interested in it as a thing whose borders that you would defend, and more as an engine that might prompt different kinds of engagement.
But, and the other, I mean, the other thing that seems to us to cross departments and disciplines is this, in the humanities, is this text, you know, to pixelation leap, sort of over all the intervening media. And I would be shocked if one doesn't find that in complement materials as we accumulate them, as much as one finds it in English materials. So this is the other thing that we speculate, you know, will be true as we continue to gather stuff from other departments. And I think it's true in history, although I at least feel on much less certain ground saying that about history.
Just one minor follow-up. Do you feel like it's also true from the perspective of rhetoric and composition? There have been, I think, a lot of bad feelings that, that digital humanities has ignored 50 years of multimodal interest.
Right. I mean, that's really interesting, and a point we should assimilate. Are you writing that down?
Make a note.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the humanities computing people know that, but it seems like once you move from humanities computing to the digital humanities, some of that legacy gets kind of dropped out.
I'm going to ask a cruder version of some of the earlier questions we had. I'm going to ask a cruder version of some of the earlier arguments or the earlier questions. One of the most interesting parts of the paper for me, or the part two of the paper, was the point where you were drawing attention to, and this is, I think, a great strength of the project, your ability to talk about current moment, not so much as a crisis, but as, you know, a very contested struggle, and there are a very contested terrain. Mm-hmm. There are possibilities for optimism and agency. And one of the things that your approach, I think, allows us to do is to look at the contemporary moment and see very clearly current modes of collaboration, I think you call them, that are happening, and they're happening in advance of theoretical or conceptual understandings of these things. And I think your phrase was, I think the collective phrase was, we need to discriminate between these different modes of collaborative endeavor that are indeed happening right now. But, you know, one thing that concerns me about the Foucauldian framework, as much as I respect it and admire it, is I'm wondering, by what criteria do you want us to make that discrimination? What is the criteria? I mean, if we see that the humanities is about instrumental logic and about governmentality, how can we discriminate among these current contemporary practices? Have we seeded the question in the words of evaluation? And in fact, does your methodology encourage us to seed, say that we have to seed the question of discrimination at the same time as you're calling us? Well, you could explain this to me, but at the same time that you're telling us we need to discriminate and evaluate, I think you're also telling me that I am powerless to discriminate and evaluate.
No, just tell us what you would like us to do, and we'll...
those are the debates that we think ought to be happening, and the problem is that they're not. That instead, a sort of blanket judgment is thrown over all digital humanities
and so it's,
projects.
And so it's quelling evaluation. It's quelling arguments about evaluation.
Right. I mean, what we would like to do is to clear enough space that those evaluative arguments could be the arguments that we need.
And we said some things about that, right? We we don't have time to really think about finely calibrated, but we provide the contrasting example of Google search and all those projects that display the expertise that goes into making them work and that think about their aims, that are kind of more explicit about what they hope to do out in the world. So we think, as a start, some kind of self-awareness that the collaboration has an object outside the university.
what the traditional English department imagined itself to be. That story begins with the projection of a mythic unity that has been lost. And that idea justifies or generates a strategy of recovery that has to do with emphasizing its integrity against an outside that threatens it. The outside you've given us has various versions. The corporation, the mass. Mm-hmm. I mean, just you've given us all these different versions of the outside that the English Department of the Humanities is continuously struggling to recover its object, this unity against. Mm-hmm. And you're suggesting as an alternative project, one that it aims at fostering small but innovative societies. Mm-hmm. What's going to enable this to happen is not assimilation or co-optation or a law of complete acquiescence, but rather modes of collaboration. I pause over Barry's excellent question, which you want to say the, sort of the basis of the collaboration, but the idea of collaboration that you're emphasizing takes its meaning or significance from its contrast with this integrity versus alien outside. And so the idea of the collaboration, in some sense, is energized by becoming involved in that outside and working with it in some way, becoming part of it, becoming internal to it in some sense. My question is, I can't help but notice that your presentation is a collaboration.
And so we were hoping you would.
And so the question I'm asking is, in this story you told, collaboration takes its meaning from a sense of something threatening to it, something that it joins in with that initially appears as a threat. And that's what fractures the story. In other words, the idea of the story is that there's something that's that at least mythically is outside that seems threatening.
No, what you said in the what you said in summarizing it was right. That in place of that story of a threatening outside, we would like to tell a different story in which the outside has already informed the inside pretty thoroughly, and that's the lesson of finding humanities in universities before their disciplinary institutionalization along the model of a department, a humanities department, to show that the traditional English department and all the other humanities disciplines are kind of saturated and informed through engagement and reaction already by the outside that they believe that they're phobic about. So we want to tell a different story than the one where good collaboration is defined by co-opting a hostile outside, right?
Yeah, I mean, but the other part of it is that English has only been struggling, it has seemed to us, to define itself in the way that you characterize since the middle of the 20th century. This is not what, you know, people who would eventually end up in Leavesite or new critical English departments would have been doing 20, 30 years earlier. And so the departments that we inherited from mid-century formations are anomalous in some way that it can be hard to see. So on both ends, it's actually existing collaboration that's interesting to us as opposed to a kind of project for what collaboration might ideally be. And on the other end, it's a genealogy that is able to understand Leavis and the New Critics as doing something comparable to what was going on before and after in terms of the sort of institutional power grab, but doing it in a very different way, the tactical retreat and the imagining of an outside that they are opposed to.
And whose power they could rival.
As opposed to the much more kind of ad hoc and on the fly stuff that was happening in the Great Books programs and such in the early decades of the 20th century, and that's happening in you know sort of sometimes really well funded, sometimes not so well funded parts of the humanities now.
Yeah, struggling with, which is I'm having trouble feeling that there's much meaning to the word collaboration. In other words, I don't know what would collaborate with what.
But can I, one of the things is that you could, I guess I would want to respond the same way to that as we responded to the idea that the digital might be invading the English department. That there is already certain kinds of collaborations going on inside the English department. It's how we work. And to the extent that Haystack digital humanities scholars sometimes believe as if, or behave as if collaboration is new, they fetishize it in precisely the way that we're trying not to. We think of it more as just simply the conditions of working in an institution. That there's the idea of the solitary pursuit is another kind of myth that we'd want, with this longer view, to begin to take apart.
So collaboration is a category for us of expert, of professionalized expert labor. I mean, is I think the first thing to say. Collaboration is not a relationship between the university and the corporation. It's a, in our account, it's a relationship between credentialed, trained, institutionally situated workers. Professionals, workers, who have relatively specialized expertise, but who want to do things outside that domain of expertise. So, yeah. So collaboration and professional division of labor, I think, are often paired in the talk, and that's what we have in mind. Yeah.
Lake, did you want to answer?
So there's a good contrast between sucky collaboration and less sucky collaboration.
And we cut out that stuff about yes. I mean, yes. And it would be interesting to think about, you know, adjunct or non-tenure track, start to think about those types of workers as potential collaborators in the other sense.
One of the other things I would say is that it's Ted Underwood Svensson who talks about librarians and all of the other kinds of labor within the academy other than professors who are engaged in what gets called digital humanities work. And so the kinds of relationships that are required to make, you know, these projects go are not limited to relations among variously paid and institutionally secure faculty members. There ought to be better ways for thinking about that stuff too, and the terms under which one collaborates with a one describes what's happening among a librarian, you know, a bunch of grad students working for more or less free, a well-paid faculty member, etc. You know, so if one looks at something like Moretti's, you know, data gathering, one ought to be able to talk about the different kinds of labor that are involved in that, as opposed to, I don't know, something like the organizational might that's put behind the Transliteracies project. And back to Barry's question, I mean, evaluate these different ways of collaborating accordingly. That, again, is not a new project.
How under this system of collaboration, think a couple questions ago, I think I kind of understood how this was going to help in some way save Native Manamis from this disillusionment, or it's falling apart, or being under attack, or being put under erasure. And then I started to get really worried with the blur between what's inside and what's outside, going back to Dr. Burke's governmentality question. It started to sound like we were suddenly the outside and the inside simultaneously, and then there was no reason for an English department. And I just wonder, under this system of collaboration, which is two academics such as yourself working together across English departments, how is it going to save English department? Like I'm a person that's supposedly going to get a degree in English and needs a job in English. And yet, there's a practical thing going on here where there's a narrowing and turning down the jobs. How is this going to actually save the humanities as a field? Like, I think I had it a couple questions ago, but I lost it.
The first thing I would say is those are not the same thing. Like, saving the humanities and saving the English department are not the same question. And that seems to us an important distinction, at least in as much as I think Mark is much less invested in saving English departments than I am. But one of the things that I like about English departments is they are ravenous. They are amazingly imperialistic. They take stuff in, they repurpose it, they do new things with it. They're really aggressive at thinking through how method informs our relationship to various kinds of objects. So I would save them in the name of that kind of practice, or I would want to argue for saving them in the name of that kind of practice. Again, you could care less, but why would you want to save a film and media studies department? Or maybe you wouldn't want to save that either.
So I think it's important. I do think it's important that we try to explain the media that inform us, and I think that film and media studies does that in ways that English departments don't. So, but I would say that
we're through.
I would say that the idea we share is that neither one of these two places should be confident in its existence because it can tell you what a novel is or what a poem is or what a film is. It has to make an argument about how those objects inform practices, right? So that would be part of my answer for why you might want to study film and media studies and why you might need some part of the university that encouraged that study. The other question, though, we've focused on the humanities,
the inside and outside.
Inside and outside, and the job issue, right? Do you want to do this, or do you want me to? I mean, the alt humanities tag is in there because we think one of the interesting things that digital humanities is doing is imagining careers for humanities graduates, and in that case specifically, a lot of English department graduates that can move outside, can then do something other than be in an English department. And we think that's interesting for a couple reasons. First of all, it's nice when people get jobs. But second of all, it suggests that English, that people trained in English departments might imagine themselves while they're being trained as potentially in conversation with other types of experts throughout the university. And we think that kind of imagination would be salutary for the discipline at this moment.
So this is another kind of argument we would like to be having instead of the ones we're having. And I do placement at Davis and send our graduate students who are preparing to go on the market to sellout.yoursoul.com, which is another place that's interested in the kind of alt academy stuff about how the skill set that one acquires in a BA or a PhD equips one to do other things than, you know, become an English professor, and whether there are choices to be made about that. The kind of discussion that very rapidly follows noticing a website like that and the rhetorical force of sell out your soul is like the fear of being useful argument that Jay and Graf make, you know, where we're not as good as I think Mark and I would like us to be about thinking the relationship between the kind of expertise that we cultivate in English departments, film and media studies departments, and the kind of expertise that circulates in a larger professional marketplace.
Inside the university, within the university,
right, and outside it. So we'd like to have better ways of thinking about that than selling out your soul.
Yeah, because that's the next question.
Yeah.
Like, why not Mark C. Taylor then? Like,
right.
Isn't that the next step in your argument?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think not Mark C. Taylor because it cedes all capacity to decide our relationship to various kinds of changes happening outside the academy to those changes. You know, so the academy just becomes a kind of sounding board for whatever stuff is said to be circulating out there, as opposed to an institution that is good at thinking about the relationship between its expertise and other forms of expertise.
Can focus on a longer, I mean, the things that humanists often say about the virtues of humanity's work can take in a longer time span than, you know, the last 5 minutes.
Right.
Is more deliberative, can have sparkling dinner table conversations, can relate domains that other experts can't relate because they're too sheltered and narrow in their own professional specialization. So there would be lots of, room for traditional arguments about what the humanities are good for, but they would need to be oriented more towards connecting than defending.
I mean, micro example of this, my department revisited its language requirement last year in large part because someone wanted to use a computer language to substitute for French or whatever. and so the debate ensued about whether we should understand this kind of requirement for the inherent virtue of learning French as opposed to C++, you know, or whether we should be thinking about this in much more utilitarian terms. Those terms won. He was allowed to take the use a computer language, and we altered our best practices accordingly. This year, someone petitioned to use to do American Sign Language instead of one of the languages. She was turned down, not because of, again, the virtue of knowing sign, but because it wasn't integrated in the project that she described herself as training to write. And so that's a kind of twist that I liked, at least. But again, I mean, I think the kinds of things that you were just saying about what the discussions happening at the MLA, the sort of the ongoing discussion that happens in the ADE bulletin, et cetera. I mean, it's not like this kind of talk isn't going on. I think that we would want to, what would I say, promote. this is the kind of talk we like, as opposed to, you know, the more defensive sort of talk. The same thing you just said. I don't know if there's a better answer than that.
I think that's an interesting example.
Okay.
I have never had the opportunity to have graduate students in film and media studies. So all my training involves teaching people in different disciplines, English, history, library and information science, women's studies, anthropology. So all these, I regularly have like all these types of students in my classroom. And so the question of what your discipline thinks about whatever it is we're talking about now often comes up. And I'm often called to explain what film and media studies might think, you know, and could you do that in 20 minutes, please, because we really didn't have time for a whole class on that. So so I would say I'm routinely involved in a lot of really sloppy, poorly informed discussions about disciplinarity, which seem to be productive for my students, and in that they seem to do more interesting projects as a result. So I would offer that as an example of the kind of thing that
we could have. Have time for one more question, or have our heads exploded?
Megan.
You're probably familiar with that essay by Julia Flanders. It was up on the All Tech website, where she talks about you teach at Brown. You work at Brown.
You're right. You work at Brown. What do you teach?
And one of the issues that comes up in that essay.
English PhD, by the way. Right? English PhD,
yeah,
right?
Right?
Yeah.
Is the question of funding. I mean, if you, the university, the institution of the university doesn't really have a place for people who have PhDs or doing intellectual labor, collaborative labor, but they're not necessarily housed in a department teaching a particular discipline of student. And I know so a lot of the collaborative projects that you mentioned, what do you see happening with the question of funding? Because, you know, collaboration a lot of times happens in sort of project-based, grant-based funding, sing for your supper kind of thing, as opposed to, you know, what we all like, which is we just get our salary for doing what we want to do.
So it's it's not entirely true that the libraries are a place in the university where people with PhDs often find homes and they don't regularly teach. And at many universities, including the one I am at now, USC and Florida State, librarians have faculty status and can earn tenure with the protections that involves. And my current position in the archive, where I report to, although I'm paid by the arts and sciences, but report to the Dean of the Libraries, as head of the film archive there, it gives me a lot of opportunities to see how librarians do this kind of thing. And I would say they're scarily much better at collaborative project management than most faculty members in the humanities are, because they regularly put together teams that might involve faculty members, librarians, graduate students, undergraduate students, and, you know, and they don't have to teach 2-2 or 4-4 or whatever, so they actually have the time, and it's part of their job description to manage these projects. And libraries have recurring funding, as well as a great desire to collaborate on grants. So I think, you know, it's not the point that digital humanities involves non-teaching faculty librarians is interesting to think about. As people look for ways to move universities, you know, to find ways to fund, to keep collaborations going that may be reliant on short-term funding to work. Yeah, so there's a place.
But the other thing to say is surplus capital is looking for a home. You know, there's money just sort of sloshing around for digital humanities projects. And
I wish someone would slosh to me.
Yeah, well, yes, we would like this. So you're suggesting this answer is resulting all. So it is partly, I think, it is what you're talking about is a failure to describe things we're already doing in ways that more accurately describe what we're already doing. You know, that there's pedagogical work as well as research work that we're engaged in that it seems to me would be not at all difficult to fit under the digital humanities umbrella if we didn't have a phobic relationship to it. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't necessarily entail doing much different from what we're doing. You know, that this is the idea of digital humanities as a big new thing keeps us, again, from recognizing the extent to which our practice already fits that category.
From the point of view of grant.
From the point of view of grant writers, or grant givers.
Grant givers.
Yeah. Please join me in thanking.